Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian roadmap through the dog days of summer, brought to you by the magazine for free minds and free markets. Don't cluck, Nick. I can hear that clucking. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, the clucker, Peter Suderman, and special guest star, Reason senior editor, the living legend himself, Jacob Sullum. You dig. Welcome, Jacob, and hello, everyone.
Hey.
Happy Monday.
Hey, Matt.
So wait, you guys are doing the delay too on purpose now?
Did Jacob say hello?
Who knows? Doesn't matter. We're just going to go through this and we're going to love it. We are not yet performing a coup against Catherine Mangu Ward, but it is fortunate that Jacob is here to do what he does best, which is to guide us through various politically supercharged stories with his trademark meticulosity and contextualness. The biggest such story as of this recording, though it may be superseded by other charges expected imminently from Special Prosecutor Jack Smith, is last week's new superseding indictment against former President Donald J. Trump in the Florida classified documents case. Introducing three new counts of willfully retaining national defense information, two new counts relating to obstruction of justice, and a new defendant in the latter conduct, a Mar-a-Lago property manager named Carlos de Oliveira. Nick, did I pronounce that right? Who reportedly told another employee that the boss, presumably not George Steinbrenner, wanted to delete security camera footage that the feds had been explicitly asking them to retain. Jacob, maybe you can start just by explaining your headline on your great post of last week. Trump's alleged cover-up of his cover-up reinforces the obstruction charges against him. How, Jacob Sullum, is the government's obstruction case now stronger, presumably, even though from all appearances, the security cam footage under question was not deleted?
Well, it looks like Trump attempted to cover up his attempt to conceal the classified documents. So initially, you have the accusation that he tried to hide them, that he defied a federal subpoena asking for them. And if you think this is all maybe a misunderstanding, that interpretation becomes less plausible if he tries to cover up the fact that he was moving files around at Mar-a-Lago, and that makes it look like he had a consciousness of guilt, consciousness of wrongdoing, and it reinforces the idea that he had criminal intent.
What can you tell us about how this adds to the case? There was a sense in the first set of indictments that came out that this was sort of unusually detailed, like the way that they were quoting things made it seem like, oh, they have more evidence than your average kind of indictment. Does this add to that sense of the prosecutor sort of showing that there is a strong prosecutorial hand based on the way these things are described?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the idea that he talked to his attorney, and it was in the original indictment, and these are notes from his attorney saying Trump, in response to the subpoena seeking all of the documents that were marked as classified, said, well, maybe we should just say we don't have them. Maybe we should make the most sensitive of them disappear. This is based on notes that his lawyer took. So that's kind of hard to get around if you're arguing that he had no criminal intent. And now, in addition to that, you have him apparently tricking his own lawyer by moving files out of the storage room at Mar-a-Lago, so that when the lawyer came back and did his diligent search in response to the subpoena, he did not find all the classified documents because some of them had been removed. And what the new indictment adds is that in addition to doing that, Trump tried to cover up the fact that he was doing it. Now, he didn't succeed, which is why they have the surveillance footage and they have these incriminating stills and incriminating video showing the documents being moved around. So in trying to defend against that charge, Biden's lawyers are going to have to argue that either he was misunderstood, so he didn't really give these instructions, or that he had other innocent reasons for behaving the way he did.
I like that.
I think you mean Trump's lawyers.
Yes,
that's not Biden's lawyers.
Did I say Biden's lawyers? Sorry, Trump's lawyers.
We got
yes.
a Mitch McConnell situation going on here.
It's Jacob's advanced generation. Nick, the timeline here is pretty damning. If what they say is true, so June 22nd, the Justice Department emails the Trump Organization saying they're about to ask for any and all surveillance records, videos, images, photographs, and or CCTV from internal cameras. That's June 22nd of last year. June 23rd, Trump allegedly calls De Oliveira for 24 minutes. Because that's, you
oh
know,
like, yeah,
24 whole minutes. Yeah. I don't, when's the last time you had a 24 minute conversation, even in person?
Especially with a lawyer, I mean, run it out to 30 minutes or something, right? Because you're going to get charged.
And then on June 27th, De Oliveira tells the employee under question that the boss wants the footage deleted. We can't do this behavior, can we?
No, but, you know, Jacob's story really lays out not only, you know, what the new indictments or charges are, but also, you know, it goes back to the thing where the things he was accused of would not necessarily, you know, end up in, you know, he wouldn't end up in jail or be that difficult. You know, it's difficult to charge somebody based on intent. And, you know, we get to this point where it's the cover up of the crime is worse than the crime itself. And I, for one, want to go back to an America where presidents, the crimes they commit are worse than the cover up. You know, for once, can we have that? You know, just where that's what would make America great again. You know, Warren G. Harding and Teapot Dome or something like that. Like, can we just fucking get a president who's evil rather than stupid? Which seems to be a recurring motif here.
Peter, this morning, Glenn Greenwald, your favorite Rumble participant, tweeted out, quote, imagine what the U.S. media would be saying if in Russia, Iran, or another bad country, TM, one opposition politician was ahead by a huge margin in all polls. I think he means internally with the Republican Party, while the government repeatedly added new criminal charges in a desperate attempt to imprison him before the election. End quote. Does Glenn Greenwald have a point, Peter Sudeman?
Well, I think it's true that there's often a lot of overheated and mistaken rhetoric about the political systems of other countries that is often, you know, sort of comes from a place of ignorance about how laws function or don't function in those countries. I think it's probably correct that if we saw, you know, Vladimir Putin attempting to imprison a political opponent in the run-up to an election, then we would say, hey, that seems kind of bad. But you know what? The difference would be that it would be Vladimir Putin doing it in a country that we tend to think of as more lawless and basically run by somebody who is a strongman authoritarian rather than run by a kind of rule of law system. And the thing here that you have to reckon with if you are a libertarian who thinks the rule of law is important is that it really kind of looks like Trump broke the law. Now, we then have to ask the question, should this law exist? Or if it should exist, should the kinds of punishments that we're talking about, quite a few years in jail, potentially, depending on how the conviction goes and sort of how, you know, if he gets convicted and how all of this would go, is that a just punishment? But if you believe that the rule of law matters and the president of the United States, or the former president of the United States, or the person who's running for president of the United States, like, isn't above the law, then you have to think, well, you know, it does look like he broke the law. What are we going to do about that? And so I think there are a couple of very reasonable ways to think about this as a libertarian. One is maybe these laws shouldn't exist, and maybe we shouldn't punish anybody, and or certainly shouldn't punish people to the extent that we're talking about potentially punishing Trump here. And you can certainly point to a lot of other examples of sort of low level people who have been punished under Records Act, records retention type of things, right? Basic for doing stuff that is not really deeply problematic, but like just like kind of dumb, right? They're not spies. They're not working directly with the Russians. They're just doing stuff that's dumb. And you could say those people should be in jail shouldn't have gone to jail for that stuff. And so Trump shouldn't go to jail either. But then you could also say, look, Trump has a special responsibility as the executive. He is somebody who swears an oath to uphold the laws of the nation. And therefore, we shouldn't say that he deserves something like special treatment. And I think if you look at the fact pattern here, one thing that you see is that the Justice Department, the authorities enforcing these records laws, bent over backwards for a long time to try and give him every possible opportunity to turn over these documents. And he just didn't. And then he tried to pretend that he wasn't. He tried to cover it up, right? He both did not turn over the documents and he tried to cover it up. And this is not appropriate behavior for someone who was a president or is running for president.
Jacob, how do you sort through some of these notions, particularly that, hey, look, one of the underlying charges is of the Espionage Act. Libertarians, usually not big fans of the Espionage Act, that has to do with a lot of classified documents. Libertarians frequently argue that there's way too much classification. And a lot of these charges are obstruction of justice rather than necessarily underlying Nick Gillespie, Warren Harding crimes. And this is kind of, libertarians are not fans of obstruction of justice or lying to the FBI type of charges. So how do you, as Captain Meticulosity, sort through those kind of competing notions
the
when you assess
of meticulosity, Matt? Come on,
that's thank you. I don't think as fast on my feet as certain impending old people do. Jacob, how do you sort through this?
Yeah, I mean, I think the charges that relate to willfully retaining national defense information will be relatively hard to prove, because they have to make the case to the jury that this material, whether it was marked as classified or not, whether you believe Trump's claims that he declassified it or not, that this represented a threat to national security, that it could be used to injure the United States or to benefit a foreign adversary. And that's very tricky, because then you have to decide how much information can you share with the jury. This is supposedly very sensitive material, in order to make that case. So that's going to be relatively hard to do. But I think the essence of what Trump did was that he made off with a bunch of stuff that didn't belong to him. So forget about the classified documents. He took thousands of documents that did not belong to him. Imagine that he had taken like all of the furniture and the oil paintings from the White House when he left.
Oh, that would have been so
and people
so
were
good.
Like, hey, we'd like that back. And he was like, first of all, I didn't take it. Second of all, I had every right to take it. Right? That would be reason to object to that. And his assertion now, his defense now, is that under the Presidential Records Act, he had complete discretion to decide what was his personal property versus what belonged in the National Archives. And that's clearly not true. Now, the Presidential Records Act does not have any penalties in itself. So you have to go to these ancillary statutes. There actually are some statutes that deal with improperly retaining, concealing, destroying government documents, classified or not. They didn't actually end up charging him under those statutes. Then you have the Espionage Act, which deals in particular with national defense information. But the basic problem is that he defied the law. He took stuff that didn't belong to him. Then when he faced a subpoena saying, give it back, he seems to have deliberately defied that subpoena. I think that there ought to be some sort of consequence to that kind of behavior. 20 years in prison? No, probably not 20 years in prison. That's the maximum penalty for each of the obstruction counts. 10 years for each of the counts related to retaining national defense information? Again, probably not. And a lot of that hinges on exactly how damaging that material may have been. But he's just so full of shit at this point that he needs to be called on it in some meaningful way. I mean, just take, for example, the one new charge related to retaining national defense information that was included in the superseding document. This is based on a meeting that he had in Bedminster, New Jersey, at his golf resort there, with researchers who were working on his former chief of staff's memoir. And we have a recording of him where he's waving around a document that he describes as classified, he describes as secret, acknowledging that you know, it remained classified, even though he's claimed he declassified stuff. And this dealt with, reportedly dealt with, possible military action against Iran. So this is a potentially sensitive thing, we can admit. We don't know exactly what the details were, but possibly abuse to a foreign adversary possibly could have been used to the disadvantage of the United States. But his defense is, no, I didn't actually do that. This is what he said in a Fox News interview last month. He said, there was no document. I didn't hold a document. These were just like newspaper clippings. And this is just, he's contradicting what he himself said on tape. And, you know, he has a long history of doing this sort of thing. But in this case, it involves actual violations of statutes that he was, especially as president, supposed to be obeying. And so I think there has to be some sort of consequence to that kind of lawlessness. Although I will grant you that the maximum criminal penalties that are allowed for these charges are excessive.
You know, I think picking up garbage on the side of the highway is always a good, you know, penalty. It's limited in time and it, you know, it serves two purposes, right? To punish and humiliate somebody, and then also to, you know, make the country a little bit cleaner. The, you know, listening to all of this and the details, I agree with everything that everybody said so far. Trump is being held accountable at the ballot box. He may get the Republican nomination in two successive, you know, presidential runs. He could not crack 47%. There's no way he is going to do better this time than he was going to do in 2020 or 2016. He will be punished. Matt, in the interest of plugging the most important book of the past 20 years in America, no, that's not. It really, that was kind of a waste of paper, if you're asking me, compared to the Declaration of Independence. Recent the latest Gallup poll of self-identification of the parties had 27% of people saying they identify as Republicans. And get this, only 25% identified as Democrats. So a plague on both their houses. Trump is terrible. He's a liar, a bullshit artist. I don't think he's the worst president we've ever had. Biden is somehow managing to alienate people just as much. And the real issue, we shouldn't get too lost in the weeds. The weeds matter, but like there is a bigger problem here, which is that both of these parties, which dominate and monopolize or cartelize or duopolize political discourse, suck and everybody knows it. And the question isn't how do you get rid of Trump? It's how do you get rid of the current Republican Party and the current Democratic Party?
I mean, the question in front of us as American citizens is, you know, what do we do about this conduct? Do we prosecute it? If we do, what kind of punishments attach? How do we have equal application of justice, which we're going to get into in the next whataboutist segment pretty soon, having to do with Hunter Biden, as Jacob was sort of trying to unwittingly tease earlier on. I agree that those are Nick's overriding issues, are definitely overriding issues about all of it. But then you do have weeds right in front of you. You can't get through the weeds, Nick, and without a weed whacker or something. Peter, quickly, if you will.
Spoken like a man who has never cut a lawn in his lifetime, Matt Welch.
Sir, I will assure you that I only used lawnmowers that didn't add to the CO2 levels. I have the carbon neutral lawnmowers for Matt Welch was part of my upbringing. Peter, save us from me talking. Just quickly, Eli Lake, to mention one person who's played a lot of miniature golf with Nick Gillespie, repeatedly sort of says that he doesn't want to see this. And he's a national security writer, and he's written, I think, interestingly and pretty balancedly about a lot of these different court cases. He'll make the argument that this shouldn't be prosecuted because the underlying statutes tend to be about, as we were saying before, Espionage Act and obstructing justice, that he wants the Warren G. Harding crime. Where do you eventually land on that scale between I want the big crime and I want the little crime to be actually punished for the health of the republic?
So your question is, should this be the domain of the lawn arm of the law?
Wow.
If I had a gun, that wow. could be broken up into little packets, internet packets, and end up in wherever you're at. I would cock it, at least. I would cock it. But how do you, would you answer the question?
So like I said, I think there are actually two completely opposite, very reasonable answers. One is that that this is political, that because it obviously is in some sense, right? Like there's no way to have a prosecution of a former president and a likely next presidential candidate that isn't in some sense political. You cannot fully depoliticize that, no matter how hard you try. So it is political. I think, you know, as Jacob said, the potential charges are excessive. We've complained repeatedly on this podcast about overclassification and about charging people for sharing classified documents and possession of classified documents in ways that's just totally unreasonable. And you can say that should just apply to Trump here. I also think, as I said before, that you can say that the president is charged with executing and upholding the laws of the country. He has a special obligation to do that. And the president, and that if we're going to live in a country where the president really isn't above the law, then you have to charge the president when he breaks the law. And so I find myself totally torn, because I think there are very good and very compelling reasons to say both, yes, this is a big deal and Trump should probably be charged with, you know, and maybe do jail time if convicted. And I also think this is kind of nonsense-y, and it is just, it's in some ways beside the point of what, of, you know, sort of the kind of the big picture policy debates that we want to be having here. And like, it also flies in the face of a lot of the logic on criminal justice and government secrets and that sort of thing that we have talked about. And so my answer is, I think that both yes and no are perfectly reasonable answers from a libertarian perspective.
Jacob, let's finish this Trump aspect of the conversation by preparing ourselves psychographically, psychonautically for what is expected to be this week's indictment in, I think, the Georgia aspect or the January 6th aspect of the special prosecution of Jack Smith. Can you just give us a little prep of what to expect, the seriousness of the charge, and what the tea leaves are kind of looking at, and maybe like what a libertarian should think? You've got 25 seconds. Go.
Well, you can take it. Yeah, there are two separate cases. I mean, there's the Georgia state case, which has to do with trying to overturn the election outcome in that state. And that may also figure in Jack Smith's investigation. And just to focus on one aspect of it, which is the so-called fake electors plan. The problem for the prosecution is that to the extent that Trump himself relied on legal advice he was getting from people like John Eastman and Rudy Giuliani, if he really believed that what they were saying was valid advice, you really have a problem proving criminal intent. In other words, if he really thought he won the election, and if he really thought that these were legally viable ways of addressing that grievance, you can't show that he, under the federal statute, that he acted corruptly, and under the Georgia statute, that he had the intent to solicit a crime. For example, you know, election fraud in Florida. So a lot hinges on what we think Trump actually believed. If he really drank his own Kool-Aid and really thought he won the election, and if he really thought he really believed the advice he was getting from his lawyers, which, by the way, is totally plausible. It's totally plausible that he believed what flattered his ego, and it's totally plausible that he only listened to the advisors who said what he wanted to hear. If that's true, I don't know if that's true or not. But it seems to me there's at least reasonable doubt as to whether that's true. And so in proving a criminal case against him in either Georgia or under federal law, they have to be able to persuade jurors that he knew what he was doing was wrong. He knew he actually didn't win re-election. He knew that the remedies he was pursuing were illegitimate. That's going to be hard to do, I think.
All right. Thank you for that, Jacob. So what about Hunter Biden? Some of you may be asking. So what about Hunter Biden? Last week, quite unusually, a previously expected plea agreement fell apart in a federal courtroom on the day it was supposed to be enacted or signed or whatever they do. Even more unusually, it involved the son of a sitting president of the United States. The judge in this case balked at language in the proposed agreement that shielded Biden, Hunter, that is, from some future federal prosecution, and that also named the judge rather than the Justice Department writ large the arbiter of whether Hunter was living up to his end of the bargain, essentially protecting the president's son from potential prosecutorial shenanigans from a future Trump DOJ. Jacob, I know that your dark heart wants to talk about the paradoxical drug and gun aspect of all of this, but I'm going to cut you off the knees, at least at the start, by focusing just on what the judge in this case last week found curious and objectionable about the agreement as set up. Was it indeed curious and objectionable? And where does that leave Hunter's legal status now?
Yes, I mean, it was there were a couple of unusual aspects to this plea agreement. To start with, there are two parts to it. So one part is the actual plea agreement, where he was supposed to plead guilty to two misdemeanor tax offenses for willfully failing to pay his income taxes. And the second was this pretrial diversion agreement on the gun charge for illegally buying a gun, even though he was a crack user at the time, which is illegal under federal law in several ways. They charged him under one particular statute, the one that relates to either receiving or possessing a gun when you are an unlawful user of a controlled substance. And that diversion agreement, in addition to saying, if he complies with the terms of this agreement for 2 years, we're not going to prosecute him on the gun charge, it also included a clause protecting him against future prosecution for the conduct that's described in the two statements of facts, one that relates to the tax offenses and one that relates to the gun charge. That was weird. And both sides, the government's lawyers and Biden's lawyers, claimed that it was not up to the judge to decide whether the pretrial diversion agreement should go through. She was only supposed to assess the plea deal part of it, but they interact with each other. And secondly, as somebody just noted, the pretrial diversion agreement, instead of saying the Justice Department, if it decides he's not living up to the terms of this agreement, and so the terms include things like avoiding drugs, avoiding guns, not just for the term of the agreement, but forever, seeking employment or maintaining employment, stuff like that. Instead of the Justice Department deciding whether he lived up to the agreement, the judge would decide, based on a preponderance of the evidence, whether he had violated its terms. And if so, then the Justice Department could pursue the gun charge after all. That's weird, because that's not the way it's usually done. Now, both of these things, both the immunity clause in the diversion agreement and this provision that says the judge decides when Biden has violated the agreement, are both very clearly designed to protect him against the possibility that his dad does not win re-election, in which case either Trump or some other Republican is in charge of the administration and very likely will reopen the investigation or pursue charges that the previous administration chose not to pursue. So they were trying to guard against that by including those provisions. And the judge thought that was basically unprecedented. I mean, she said, I've never seen any kind of deal where you have a diversion agreement that includes provisions like these. And Biden's lawyers said, yeah, well, we're not aware of any such example either, right? So now they're back to the drawing board, and they have to come up with some sort of agreement that's acceptable to the judge.
Peter, do you think, given this, that it is reasonable to conclude, as a whole lot of conservatives and Republicans have concluded, that Hunter Biden is receiving special treatment because his father is the president?
I think it's hard to imagine that that's not on the minds of the people involved in the case, right? Like they're aware of who Hunter Biden is and who his dad is. And even in the most neutral possible scenario, in which like somehow or another you could know these people really, the folks involved were really just, they didn't want to bring politics into this at all. It's unavoidable. And how much of that ends up being special treatment and how much of that ends up being, we want to get this done and get this out of the realm, sort of not like hand this over to the political system, is hard to say. But I think it's it's just, as with Trump, it's totally unavoidable that it's not like you're dealing with somebody who has a clear connection to the Oval Office. And that means that things are going to be different. I don't see how you can, how you could have this go any other way.
Nick Gillespie, two-part question. First part is, there's been talk, maybe too much talk. Mm. That's a deep cut there. Yeah. Kevin McCarthy, the Bakersfield Comet, and some other people about possible impeachment proceedings.
Yeah, nice. A real patriot, Kevin McCarthy.
Impeachment proceedings. Rand Paul, senator from Kentucky, is more reluctant to think about that. So the first part of the question is, what think you about impeachment proceedings? And then the more important second part is, where does Hunter Biden rank in the Billy Carter, Roger Clinton sweepstakes of embarrassing member of the first family?
Yeah, that, well, you know, to the first part of the question, which I've already forgotten.
So impeachments.
Yeah, I know this podcast has a history of people saying, you know, we need to impeach more presidents or impeach presidents more often. I say no to that. I don't think Trump should have been impeached, and I don't think Biden should be impeached over this. There's, you know, an argument. I want to know whether or not he was involved in helping his son get business deals, you know, back when he was vice president, or if anything persisted since then, because that's really awful, although it's totally predictable and kind of understandable in the same way Peter was saying. You know, of course, I mean, of course, if your father's president, you're going to get different treatment, you know, and it conceivably could go worse for you, you know, because people could be gunning for you, but I doubt that, you know, but no, I don't want to see impeachment over this. You know, I don't want to see impeachment unless a president is doing something where they really need to be removed from office immediately. It seems to me like impeachment has a shitty record in America. You know, of the way that it works out and the reasons that it's brought. And then for the second question, I think that Hunter Biden is probably going to top everybody, especially if he keeps living in the White House and leaving cocaine around, you know, and doing,
he wouldn't leave it around,
you know, having sex parties at Camp David. You know, or gender reveal parties of newly found illegitimate kids that he has and stuff like that. I think Hunter Biden could go straight to the top of the worst, you know, offspring slash relative of a president in history.
Certainly some of the most exciting video footage of
it's great. Yeah. I mean, I have a soft spot for Jimmy for Billy Carter, but I think, Matt, this is like, you know, people tend to like the James Bond, the actor who played James Bond whenever they came of age or first saw a James Bond movie, which is why I'm a Roger Moore guy. The first James Bond movie I saw in the theater was The Spy Who Loved Me. And yeah, it's Roger Moore all the way. I think I have a soft spot for Billy Carter because it's around the same time that he came into the, you know, national consciousness by, you know, getting caught urinating on airstrips and cashing in with Billy Beer and all of that kind of stuff. So I love Billy Carter, but I think Hunter is the Roger Federer of you know, presidential relatives.
Spy Who Loved Me, inarguably the best Bond theme song. And I will not be taking questions at this time.
No.
Jacob, to put a bow on things here, can you please actually indulge in your gun drug arbitrariness argument as the author of the acclaimed book Saying Yes, whose clips have you talked
in defense of drug use,
one of the best exchanges that anyone should ever see, talk about the drug gun weirdness of this particular case with Hunter Biden.
So the law he's charged with violating, which he very clearly violated, should not exist. It says that someone who is an illegal drug user, which would include cannabis consumers, regardless of whether marijuana is legal in your state, it would include even people who use somebody else's prescription drug, right? Without the not under a doctor's direction. And of course, it would include your average crack user. That in itself, the fact that you're using an illegal drug, means that you don't have any Second Amendment rights, according to the federal government. And I think that's pretty clearly unconstitutional. It's definitely unjust. So nobody should go to prison for that. Add to that the fact that this is actually multiple felonies under federal law, each of which is punishable by theoretically very harsh prison sentences. And you start to see the insanity of this. One other note about this is that he would not have been charged with this at all if he had not used crack. But then when you ask, why did he get this diversion agreement? It seems to be mainly because he was a crack user, because he had a drug problem and he was nonviolent and he didn't have a criminal history. These things, all these things figure into it. He was deemed eligible for a diversion program. That's not unheard of, right? Depending upon your criminal history. And these the kinds of agreements tend to favor people who have drug problems because that's seen as a mitigating factor. So you have it being both the reason why he was charged with this crime and the reason that he's not being prosecuted for this crime, which seems kind of insane on the face of it. But if you ask, is he getting special treatment? I agree with Peter. There's no way that was not a factor in the thinking of the people, of the prosecutors involved in this. But if you look at how people are typically treated when they violate these laws against so-called prohibited persons owning guns, first of all, almost none of them are ever caught, right? If you're a drug user and you buy a gun, generally speaking, nobody knows that. So in this case, his drug problem was widely known. So that's one thing. So he was among the very tiny number, a percentage of drug users who own guns who actually got caught doing that. Then you ask, what happens when those people are caught? They're almost never prosecuted. So if somebody tries to buy a gun and they're flagged for it, now this could be disqualification, not just for drug use, but for a criminal record or for a psychiatric record. They're almost never prosecuted for that. So he's in among a tiny percentage of people who actually had a charge brought against him for this. And then you ask, what's the typical treatment of people in that situation? Well, it depends. So if you look at people who actually are prosecuted, the average sentence for violating that general provision about prohibited persons owning guns is something like 5 years. But typically those people have felony records. He does not. So there's an argument to be made that this is not so unusual. He's somebody without a criminal record, a nonviolent offender. He had drug problems, which, of course, is the reason he was charged to begin with. And we think that he's a suitable candidate for diversion. I don't know if that's really true. I suspect if he, you know, did not have these connections, if he were a poor black guy in similar circumstances, that he would not have been treated as leniently. But contrary to what I've been hearing from a lot of readers, that doesn't mean that justice is served by sending this particular defendant to prison. Nobody should go to prison for this sort of crime, which is victimless, does not involve violating anyone's rights. And it does not make the system more just to send yet another person to prison for that.
All right. We're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, a reminder that this episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Friends, all day long, from waking up to passing out with a thud, we are navigating through this great thing called life, getting from point A to point B, darting through the minefields of work, family, podcasts, maniacs in the subway, you name it. We steer this ship of self every conscious minute of the day, and yet we do not often pause to consider the very navigation system that's getting us through. Professional therapy can be your map through the challenging and occasionally treacherous terrain all around you, helping you choose wiser paths and letting some of the overworked mental equipment rest. BetterHelp Online Therapy is an easy-to-use, super flexible, entirely online therapy service that has helped many listeners of this very podcast. All you have to do is fill out a quick questionnaire, get matched with a therapist, and if you don't like the first one, just swap them out for a second. Let therapy be your own internal GPS system with BetterHelp. Just visit betterhelp.com/roundtable right now to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, reminder to please email your short queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one, versions of which we've been getting a lot of, comes from Jonathan Klibben, who writes, I've been following the recent developments in my home state of Oregon, where a path towards drug decriminalization has been taken, a move typically supported by libertarians. However, a recent article in The Atlantic suggests that this initiative may not be progressing as well as expected. I'm sure you're familiar with the Chesterton's fence principle. It's hard to say. Before you tear down a fence, it's wise to understand why it was put up in the first place. This concept appears to be echoed by one of the activists quoted in the article, who pointed out, if you take away the criminal justice system as a pathway that gets people into treatment, you need to think about what is going to replace it. Raises the thought, provoking questions, are libertarians optimizing for individual freedom, potentially overshadowing the broader societal outcomes? I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts on this. In the context of drug decriminalization, how can we balance the libertarian emphasis on individual freedom with societal well-being? Additionally, how might Oregon improve its approach to drug decriminalization while still respecting libertarian values? I know we've been going to Jacob first on every question, but we kind of have to go to Jacob first on this, I feel like. As the author of Saying Yes, Jacob, what say you about the questioner's question?
Well, I think the assumption that the threat of prison is a good way to get people into treatment, and that it has good outcomes, that's unproven, that premise. Morally, it is certainly questionable. We don't treat drinkers that way. When you have heavy drinkers, unless they violate some other law, we don't legally force them into treatment by threatening to imprison them. So why should this be different? The theory behind decriminalization, that is removing criminal penalties for use and small-scale possession of drugs, is that in itself is unjust, that they're not doing anything that should be treated as a crime. So given that, I don't see how you can not decriminalize. Whether it has negative impacts down the line is an open question. I don't think the situation in Oregon validates that belief. They're not doing well, but there's not evidence that they're doing worse as a result of this policy change than the rest of the country. In other words, drug-related deaths continue to escalate, and that's true across the country. So the issue is this law justified to begin with? Is it justified to threaten people with jail simply because they use intoxicants that the government has arbitrarily decided to ban? And if the answer is no, then that's the end of the analysis as far as I'm concerned. The law is simply not morally justified.
Yeah, but I agree with that, Jacob, obviously. But the question is really, how does this affect the experiments in decriminalization or legalization? And if there's a perception that social chaos follows decriminalization, that's something that needs to be dealt with. And it can be dealt with partly by pointing out, when you look at the death rate for overdoses in Oregon, it's doing better than nearby Washington state. It's about the same as California, et cetera. So it's not, Oregon is not the worst state in the world for any of this. I mean, and you can go to, Pennsylvania, basically, Western Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee have much worse rates. So do Ohio and Indiana and Missouri and things like that. So it needs to be put in context for sure. I think about the treatment issues here because there is no question that, scaring people or forcing them at the, you either go to jail or you go into some treatment program does have an effect. It does put people into treatment. You take that away, there might be fewer. I think what's actually going on in Oregon, and when you look at it, the state bureaucracy has not shifted into offering any kind of rehabilitation programs. They are not doing well shifting out of a kind of abstinence-only AA model, which is huge all over the country, but especially on the West Coast, to harm reduction methods. And harm reduction, which the letter writer, I think, mentions, and it's in the Atlanta article, is the future of helping people who have substance abuse problems. And harm reduction replaces the insistence that you have to be sober for the rest of your life, that you have to be abstinent, with instead looking at ways that you reduce the social harms caused by substance abuse. It's a much better and more effective way of treating treatment, but it's going to take a while to get that in place because the way treatment is done in the U.S. is almost always opposed to harm reduction, to the point that if you are in a rehab program and you relapse, you get kicked out of the program, which, on its face doesn't make a lot of sense. So there are real issues here, but I think part of it is putting, you know, making the moral case that Jacob's talking about. We need to live in a free society, first and foremost. And then secondly, putting what's happening in Oregon in context of the rest of the country, but then also looking at what are treatment programs that work. And we don't, you know, Oregon needs to get its act together on that.
Peter, let me maybe modify the Chesterton. I can't do that.
Call it the GK. Fence. The GK fence, okay? For GK
DKC, Nick, all the way down. Anyways, that quote is, before you turn out a fence, it's wise to understand why it was put up in the first place. Before you tear down a fence, you should think about what you're going to replace it with. Do you think that that new Welch fence is one worth contemplating, and that libertarians haven't been doing, or decriminalizers, whatever you want to call people who are involved in the drug laws, it's a criticism that they perhaps deserve?
I'm really glad that we're focusing on all aspects of lawn care here. We've got mowing. We've
edging.
Got fences, we're going to get some, I'm sure there's going to be like some tree branch cutting. That's not an unreasonable way to put it, Matt. I think the way that I would respond to this this question is that if the problem is that abuse of drugs is getting worse somehow, and I think that that's at least in question about whether that's actually happening, given the comparative stats that Nick mentioned here. But if that is the problem that we want to deal with, then deal with the abuse. Figure out a treatment regime of some sort. Because jailing users pushes the abusers, the people who have serious problems, into the shadows and into black markets that are worse with them. That is the big lesson that, from prohibition, from alcohol prohibition. And if you've studied alcohol prohibition at all, what you saw is that, yes, alcohol prohibition did cut drinking by about a third, according to most estimates. It's somewhere in the range of 30 to 40% alcohol consumption reduction during prohibition. So that's a big effect. It's not that everyone kept drinking at the exact same rate. But who stopped drinking? It was the casual drinkers, the people who didn't have anything like problems. Meanwhile, the people who had alcohol abuse issues, who had addiction issues, they kept drinking, except that the stuff they were drinking was a lot worse. And I don't just mean a lot worse as in it tasted worse, although it did. The stuff they were drinking was more likely to kill them. It was less, right? It was just less likely to be safe overall. And also, as they were drinking, right, they were involved in a criminal enterprise that had a bunch of people with guns and a bunch of people who were willing to kill you, maybe, if they didn't like you, because it was all happening in the black market. We don't want transactions happening in the black market. We don't want that to be the case with, we didn't want that to be the case with alcohol, and we don't want that to be the case with drugs right now. And so you've got to bring this stuff into the light somehow. And then if there are issues that need to be dealt with, deal with the medical addiction issues. Deal with abuse as abuse, not as something that you want to criminalize and throw people in jail for. The other thing that I would say, having looked back and read a lot of the contemporaneous literature around prohibition, even the wets at the time, there's this interesting thing that we've forgotten. Even the folks who wanted to get rid of prohibition and say, okay, we're going to make alcohol legal again, a lot of them were actually quite cautious about legalizing hard liquor and also about bringing back saloon culture. Maybe not the majority of them, but certainly there was a strong contingent of wets who were like, well, of course, you know, we don't want to have prohibition, but we're not so sure about this whiskey stuff because that's really just going to mess with people's minds. And we can see that that just destroys lives. And I think you're seeing something similar here with as we are moving into drug legalization, is that even people who sort of nominally feel like, well, you know, I don't like the old prohibition regime, but boy, if we're gonna have all of these drugs, it's not just like light weed, right? Like the stuff that we had in the 70s that wasn't very powerful, then maybe that's too far. And I think the lesson of ending prohibition is, no, that wasn't too far. High proof whiskey is great. There's an art to it. It's wonderful. I've got probably 100 bottles of the stuff, you know, on my shelf here in my basement right now. It's like, that was an understandable instinct in some ways, because yes, of course, like high proof liquor is different than beer. On the other hand, it would have been a mistake to only legalize beer and wine, and it would have been a mistake predicated on some bad ideas and some mistaken assumptions about how those things work and how people respond.
All right, let's get to our end of podcast, what we have all been consuming in the cultural sphere. Nick Gillespie, why don't you lead us off?
All right. I was playing around with the wonderful new website from the Cato Institute's David J. Beer and Alex Narasta. It's called The Green Card Game. And what it basically does is it allows people to enter, enter their name or an avatar, and then they can walk through the immigration process for legal immigration to the United States. And it's basically like a flow chart from hell, which Reason published some years ago, I believe, under your editorial guidance, Matt Welch.
Leadership, I like to think.
Okay. In any case, the fewer than about 1% of the people who want to move here legally qualify for legal immigration. And when you walk through this process, you can try, you go through and you get rejected again and again, and then you try to tweak to see how can you get in. And it's really difficult. And I think it's a great, kind of way of learning what it is like, how expensive it is to emigrate to the United States, even before you find out whether you're coming here. Because in any country, you're racking up hundreds, if not thousands of dollars in fees just to see if you can get denied, whatnot. And I think it's really instructive. Obviously, I'm very in favor of maximum immigration to the country. I think it should be done. Basically, as long as you don't have a violent criminal record and or a serious communicable disease, you should be allowed to come here and live and work openly. You shouldn't be, shouldn't qualify for welfare and transfer payments and things like that. But that's the law as it is now anyway. This really drives home how hard it is to get to the nation of immigrants. And so I recommend people playing around with the green card game and seeing if they can find the path to citizenship, because by and large, the answer is no. And that's bad. It's bad for the people who want to come here, but it's also especially bad for the United States. We need more people. We need more workers. We need more ideas and, fresh legs, so to speak, to help propel us into, continued improvement and whatnot. And the green card game makes it clear that we are doing everything possible to keep as many people out as possible.
I believe that those guys flashed a version of their flow chart on the floor of Congress last week. So congrats to them for showing that. I don't know if it was the exact cover line, but it was certainly the one in my head when we did that 15 years ago or whatever it was. But it was, what part of legal immigration do you not understand? Because I mean, so many people use that. What part about illegal? Don't you understand? Most people just don't realize how difficult it is to get in line. That it takes forever. Actually, it was get in line now, stay out, I think was the eventual one. Jacob Solub, or as my wife says, Jacob Sulum. What have you consumed?
I'm in the middle of Don Fehrenbacher's book about the Dred Scott case, which was published back in, I think, 1978. Ooh. And it's like 600 or 700.
Can we tell you how it turns out?
No, don't spoil it. No spoilers.
Okay.
It's like 600 or 700 pages. And initially I was like, is that strictly speaking necessary? But I have to tell you that so far, like, all of the detail is really fascinating, because this weaves together all of these different questions about slavery, about the Constitution, about, just to take one example, these Southerners who early on were like, well, slavery obviously is terrible and evil. Too bad we can't get rid of it. And this is their attitude, in the 18th century, or in the early 19th century, and only later became really a hardcore defense of slavery on moral grounds and on constitutional grounds. So he kind of walks you through all of these different controversies leading up to what was decided in that case, which ostensibly was addressing, first of all, Congress's authority over territories vis-a-vis slavery, and what happens when somebody stays in a place where slavery is prohibited for a while. Is he then free even when he goes back to the other state? So it's really, anybody who's interested in that stuff, I highly recommend the book. It doesn't feel at all dated, it's full of really interesting insights.
Very good. Peter Sudeman, what have you been consuming?
I watched season one of The Bear. It's a series about a high-end, fancy restaurant cook who goes home to Chicago to take over his brother's definitely not high-end beef sandwich shop after his brother dies. It's great. It's really smartly written, just kind of brutal and funny and like grimy about human relationships and work. There's some really innovative direction and acting. In particular, there's one episode in the season that follows a kitchen meltdown in a single shot that is the whole episode. So the whole episode is just one single shot of a kitchen just absolutely kind of collapsing, which if you've ever worked in a kitchen is the kind of thing that happens. It's also super intense. I've heard some people describe watching it as stressful. I even heard people say, I tried watching the first episode and it was too much. I just couldn't. And like, the main characters having like work dreams about like kitchen accidents and screw ups all the time, which again, if you've ever worked in a restaurant, the most intense, like crazy making work dreams I've ever had were when I was working summers serving at a big seafood restaurant in Florida. And I'd work 60 hours a week and then go home, you know, each night and sleep and dream for 8 hours about serving and about like meltdowns, you know, in the kitchen and in the serving. And so it really captures with, you know, some dramatic flourishes the manic reality of restaurant work at any level. And it's also just a kind of smartly written show about the difficulty of running and maintaining a small business and how much of it is just record keeping and management and administrative procedures and sort of like getting stuff in order, even if you're in business trying to make an artful product and you want to make something beautiful and wonderful and send it out in the world. It just doesn't matter if your sandwich tastes amazing, if the ordering system is screwed up and like the printer doesn't work and stuff is, you know, and like your stove is melting down. And so it's just a great show about work and life and small businesses and Chicago and tasty food. The Bear season one. I know there's a season two. Please don't tell me what happens. Planning to watch it in the next.
I think what happens.
Peter, is Cocaine Bear a prequel or a sequel?
I don't think that's been revealed yet.
Okay.
I watched a movie that was talked about at length last week, Oppenheimer. So I'm not gonna talk too much or at all even really about it. I liked it a lot.
Would you say it was the bomb?
Very, you know, this as is always,
dad jokes from a man without children. I don't know. It's like it's
Uncle
ironic.
Jokes, as my
Uncle jokes,
as okay. my 8-year-old calls them. Great managerial fable, etc. But the aspect of it that I would like to just highlight was, I think it was the first time in at least since COVID that I have been in a completely full theater watching a movie. I'm not one of those people who normally like waxes poetical about, you know, being in the dark with a bunch of people, strangers, and all experiencing something for the first time, mostly because I don't like strangers and I'm claustrophobic and I don't want to hear people eating popcorn anywhere near me. It's disgusting. But they're kind of right. It was really awesome to be in a completely full theater watching a really nice cinematic experience. I had forgotten that feeling, and it's a great feeling. And so that's all I want to say about that. That, and it's a good movie, and Gillespie's obviously wrong about
what
of it all. Just everything that you said. Yeah. No. I don't think that it needed to show faces melting in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yeah, because you don't want to deal with the actual history of dropping A-bombs, for good or bad.
No, that's
actually
not the reason.
Did anybody shout out the movie when the bomb landed? Did anybody shout, "That's gotta hurt"? I really wanted to do that, but I would have lost 4 major relationships in my life if I had. But I was really hoping somebody else.
The
would
turmoil
do that.
Inside of you is so much more than the sexual proclivities of a weird human chain.
I'm hoping
cipher.
Oppenheimer brings back high-waisted pants. You know, now that I'm a week away from turning 60, that's the other big reveal, Matt. You know, wearing pants that come up to your nipples. Come on, like, why not?
Yeah, with a tie that doesn't make the belt too, which is
with like
also,
a Bud Abbott tie. I don't get it, but
it's fantastic. All right, speaking of fantastic, that's all the time we have for this wonderful Jacob Sullum bejeweled podcast. If you like what we do, please consume more of it at reason.com/podcasts. And speaking of which, oh my God, you cannot contain my enthusiasm. You can only hope to stop it. Wait, did I get that backwards? Anyways, we have a brand new podcast coming down. It's a limited edition series, so collect them at home and hold on to them forever and then trade them later for multiples of the value. It's hosted by Eric Boehm, if that's how his last name is pronounced. It's called Why We Can't Have Nice Things. It's going to debut on August 3rd. That's this week, I think. It's a podcast series about how free markets want to deliver the goods, but government keeps getting in the way, often because special interests use the power of the state to shut down competition or block new ideas, from the recent baby formula shortage to the unseen taxes making your underwear more expensive, as if Nick Gillespie even wears underwear. We're bringing you six stories about how bad trade policy makes everything more expensive and pulling back the curtain on the political mechanisms responsible. Good copy there, whoever wrote that. This is Why We Can't Have Nice Things. It's going to be available at the aforementioned reason.com/podcasts. Awesome. Very excited about that. Nick, do you have anything else exciting in the Gillespie domain of reason.com and.org and.edu that you would like to share?
Yeah. On Wednesday, we're going to be releasing a video and podcast version of an interview I did with the great comedian Doug Stanhope. Whilst at Freedom Fest in Memphis, the annual gathering held this year in Memphis. And it's pretty, pretty, pretty good. I'll tell you that much.
I hope it's better than his actual stand-up name-checking of Nick Gillespie, which is very uncomfortable to watch.
You know, it was a little bit sexually titillating to me because he said that I was the one man that he would want to have sex with.
I wish that we could just airbrush this entire notion from our collective.
I want to go into a drug treatment program right now, and I'm willing to do it or go to prison. Either way, I just want to get away from this conversation.
Thank you once again to Jacob Sullivan and everyone else for listening. If you like our organization-wide efforts to make the world a more free and awesome place, go to reason.com/donate. Give us money. Thanks. And we'll catch you next week. Goodbye.